from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working with students and families to improve college access and student success for a better West Virginia. West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu.
Good evening, I'm Andrea Lanham, and this is the Legislature Today from the Capitol Building in Charleston. We'll have extended excerpts of a meeting on the Campus Self-Defense Act, which would allow those with concealed weapons licenses to carry guns on campuses in West Virginia. I'll be joined in a few minutes by some colleagues of mine who are also here covering activity at the State House. But first, an oil and gas bill was the focus of a public hearing this morning. The issue is called co-tenancy and would allow companies to drill wells on property with consent of at least 3/4 of the landowners. Rebecca Turnbull reports.
Tensions ran high.
Drag me off then.
As people stood their ground in a public hearing this morning to show their opposition or support of a bill that could change how co-tenancy is handled in oil and gas development. House Bill 4268 would allow companies to drill wells on property with the consent of at least 3/4 of the landowners instead of all of them. Proponents of the bill say this is a much-needed change.
As the law stands today in West Virginia, one co-owner or one co-tenant, no matter how small of an ownership interest, can prevent a well from being drilled. This is grossly wrong and unfair to the supermajority of willing co-tenants.
This concern has become increasingly important to those in the oil and gas industry as downstream opportunities and investments are being announced throughout the country.
We need to get to the natural gas and the natural gas liquids in order to make those opportunities possible, all of which will keep that natural gas resource right here in West Virginia, and that's the opportunity to create thousands and thousands of jobs. This is a long-term investment opportunity, but we've got to be able to get to the natural gas.
At the hearing today, one industry leader said West Virginia is one of only 3 states in the nation to have a co-tenancy law like this, where it only takes one landowner to say no to stop a drilling project. Other proponents of the bill said that this fact puts the state at a major disadvantage when competing with surrounding states.
We can sit on the sidelines here in West Virginia and watch growth take place in our neighboring states, or we can act to maximize the benefits of shale and its derivatives within our borders.
But some in the industry are more concerned about the effects this could have on the protection of landowners' rights to due process.
It's not even a take it or leave it, it's just a take it. The compensation is tied only to the tract in question and may not be a true market value in the area. The only recourse left to the owner is to file suit in circuit court to have the law set aside, which is in favor of the operator, who is, in most cases, have much deeper pockets.
However, the most significant factor cited in favor of the bill was its potential effects on providing jobs to the state. Business leaders say they hope lawmakers will fulfill their promises to revitalize the economy by passing this legislation.
Many of you in the legislature campaigned on this. You pledged to promote policies to create jobs. I'd be hard-pressed to name another piece of legislation that has the potential that co-tenancy modernization does for growing jobs in West Virginia.
Some at the hearing say they are just as hard-pressed to see how those growing jobs would come about.
As far as jobs, the word job, I cannot find that word anywhere in this bill. It is only implied by people. People whisper about it. People whisper numbers, like 75% of people approving of this. I've never seen a poll to that effect. Nobody ever asked me my opinion.
It's not going to make a single another job for the guy out there on the ground working. If anything, it's going to mean less laterals, and that means less wells, and that means less jobs in our state.
Aside from jobs, some people are more worried about the environmental impacts of the bill and how that could affect the amount of people who choose to stay in West Virginia.
What we need is an investment in our passionate residents who want to make West Virginia the best that it can be, not legislation that strips people of their rights. forcing aspiring farmers to leave West Virginia or encouraging potential residents to avoid this state is not an option at this time when we so desperately need to create viable career opportunities that encourage young people to stay here.
Members of the industry say that while they recognize concerns on both sides of the issue, they still believe the bill is a good first attempt at bringing West Virginia in line with the rest of the nation. For the Legislature Today, I'm Rebecca Turnbull at the Capitol.
Joining us now for our Friday evening reporters wrap-up are Jake Zuckerman of the Charleston Gazette-Mail and Brad McElhenney of West Virginia Metro News. Guys, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Anytime.
So, Jake, what can you add about the co-tenancy bill and some of the debate that we heard this morning?
Well, I think hanging over the whole thing a little bit is the storage hub and the China energy deal. I think it'd be a mistake to think that parties to both those deals aren't watching this eagerly. And now that it's coming to the floor, it seems like whatever's going to happen is going to happen, and the ball's rolling.
Brad, what are some of the other points being made by both supporters and opponents? And there's some other oil and gas legislation being proposed as well.
Well, this was a debate that lingered all day long, and the House Judiciary Committee actually just passed that bill out moments before I came out to join you guys. But you know, this has been a real balancing act among industry, royalty owners, landowners, people advocating for those who may not want to take part in drilling. And Governor Justice brought some of those groups together before the session even started, and the bill that we're seeing has been a byproduct of those negotiations that have come along. What I heard this morning during that public hearing was some people, particularly industry, saying, I like the bill as it came out of the Energy Committee. Well, what was going on was that there had been some changes to the language to be introduced in judiciary today. That language was meant to be at the behest of one of the surface rights owners organizations. But the issue was, would industry still buy in? So when we thought judiciary was going to talk about that bill this morning, they wound up saying, let's wait until this afternoon. They all got together, wound up meeting this afternoon as planned, and passed the bill after some debate over amendments. But you know, to ask people, do you support it or do you not, that remains fluid even after it's passed out of committee. Some of the energy lobbyists are out going through the language right now, and some of the others have said, yes, I support it, but it very well could change.
So you had mentioned some of the changes that was happening in judiciary, some of the changes that were proposed, especially with the people saying that they supported the version that came out of energy. Can you describe some of the changes that you think they were talking about this morning?
Yeah, these were meant to be, the bill is described as the Majority Protection Act, meaning that the 75% or so of those who wanted to take part in drilling can say so without being held up by potentially the 25% who do not. But the 25% who don't want to be a part of this still need to have some rights, some rights to if they're going to be in, to profit off of what they didn't want to do in the first place. So these were provisions that were meant to shore up the rights of that minority, including some things having to do with these well pads are just enormous. And so if you're drilling horizontally underneath the well pad, but your property is maybe not where the well pad is, but it may be affected because it's going under, there were provisions for those folks too, potentially being discussed. So this is all just part of how complicated this bill is and the various groups that need to buy in to get it through the legislative process.
Now, regarding co-tenancy, a lot of people have mentioned that this bill has been debated for years. What do you see as far as momentum goes for this session? Do you think that it's going to make its way through? Jake, I'll start with you.
Yeah, well, I think the 75 threshold is going to get a lot of people in, and I know that some of the surface owner organizations, I know David McMahon is tentatively on the side of this bill, so the question is going to be, how strict is it going to be? What kind of recourses will some of the minority have if they object to their tract of land being used? I think that's going to be a big part of it. And also, I'm wondering how some of the more conservative legislators, some of the libertarian people, are going to feel about a form of eminent domain coming from private industry.
Brad, what's your take on it?
Well, I mean, if you can view judiciary as a subgroup, all the Republicans voted for it and all the Democrats against. But you do have the Liberty Caucus, which may weigh in on behalf or on the side of the minority property owners. I think it's probably going to go through, but should any part of it change, it's a pretty fragile bill.
Now, Jake, you had mentioned the China energy deal. How is this involved with that from what we know of it so far?
Well, it's a little hard to say because no one seems to have gotten their hands on the MOU, but that's a pretty big investment in natural gas, and something like this could free up a lot of tracts of land to natural gas where, like we saw in that clip, you know, right now, one owner in a tract of 100 people who own it could nix a whole deal. So this really brings a lot of land into play. So I'd assume that any interested parties in that deal are going to be eyeballing this very closely.
Speaking of the Memorandum of Understanding, the very first speaker in this public hearing today was Woody Thrasher, the Commerce Secretary, who talked not explicitly about the China deal, but about West Virginia competing on supply of natural gas with Pennsylvania and Ohio.
Now, kind of related to that, the governor was asked yesterday about taxing oil and gas production to help with the hole in PEIA. And he said he brought up his severance hearing that he had proposed last year and said that the legislature wouldn't support him in that. And of course, the Senate President and House Speaker were both standing beside him when he was talking about that. This legislature isn't going to consider that this year, are they? Even though I know Senator Ojeda has proposed a bill for severance tax. Brad, I'll start with you.
You know, Democrats have talked about it, and Senator Ojeda, Senator Facemeyer, I've heard both of those guys talk about variations on a greater severance tax on natural gas. When the governor got stakeholders together prior to the session, I feel like that certainly was part of the discussion. But the only thing that really seems to be going forward is this co-tenancy bill, which is cobbled together, as I've already said, among various people who want different things out of it. The governor talked about kind of a carrot and a stick approach. If you can give industry something it wants, then maybe you can raise the severance tax. It seems to me like if they want co-tenancy enough or some other sort of drilling bill, then maybe that's where the opportunity lies to say, well, guess what, we're going to raise severance tax also. But the governor clearly said he doesn't think the time is right. And we reached the 30-day mark. We're halfway through. So if it were going to happen, it would need to happen quickly.
Now, switching gears a little bit, we were in the Senate today, and the Senate passed SJR 12. Again, this is a proposed constitutional amendment that says there is no right under the state constitution for abortion. Let's listen to part of that debate on the Senate floor today.
If we were having children and promising to put a roof over their head and give them a good education and food on their table and medical care, I'd stand at the front gates with you. But we're not doing that. We're taking that away from children. We do it here every day. We've done it every day since I've been here. But what we are going to do here today is not right. And those of you that, you know, those of you that take oaths to protect people's lives, I don't know how you can vote for this. But I know you're going to. But I want you to know that the reason I'm going to vote against it is real simple. I'm not going to be responsible for taking a woman's life because I think my judgment is somehow more important than theirs.
Now, we recognize that our Constitution has established three branches of our government. But when there becomes a question, like in this particular case, that we're not sure, more importantly, when there's a conflict between bodies of the government, our Constitution provides that we put it back to we the people. Mr. President, this has been a long-standing debate back and forth between various parties on this particular issue. I think the wording of the particular constitutional amendment, the resolution that we have before us today, nothing in the Constitution secures or protects a right to abortion or requires the funding of abortion, is brief, it's clear, but more importantly, it gives the people of West Virginia the opportunity to vote to establish what we the people believe in. And so for that purpose, Mr. President, I urge passage of this resolution.
So one thing that was rather unusual when this happened was when this bill passed, people in the gallery stood up and said, shame. Jake, what was your take on that?
Well, I actually had the chance to speak with some of them. They were in from Jefferson County, and yeah, I mean, there were a bunch of women screaming at a group of at least a male-dominated group, calling shame on the fact that a constitutional amendment has been made, which, if passed, would give the legislature the right to curtail certain abortion rights, and it seems like the target would be the Medicaid funding of abortion, and yeah, they're not happy about it, and they were asked to leave by the Senate president. It was somewhere between being kicked out and asked to leave, but it was a tense situation.
And another thing that was kind of interesting is that three Democrats joined Republicans in voting for this measure. Brad, did you notice that as well?
Well, yeah, because actually, as Jake pointed out, if the resolution were going to be defeated, it was probably going to rely on every Democrat to do so. And it wound up losing by three. So, yeah, I mean, the Democratic votes counted. One was the minority leader, Roman Prezioso, also Mike Waffle and John Unger. And, you know, I didn't get a chance to ask them. None of them spoke during the session. But, you know, I don't know what their voting history on abortion is. But anyway, the Democratic caucus didn't hold.
So one of the things that had happened while we were covering the co-tenancy measure was this Campus Self-Defense Act. We've received emails from university groups opposed to this act, which would allow those with a license to carry concealed weapons to do so on a college campus at all functions with less than 5,000 people. Only 10 other states allow this on college campuses. Here's some of the testimony this morning that we heard on House Bill 4298.
The way I interpret it is that the drafters wanted to make sure that the Higher Education Policy Commission, the Community and Technical College Council, the Institutional Boards of Governors, and anyone in higher education governance could not make rules regarding the carrying or not carrying or not being able to carry a gun on campus.
Why should we not allow the institutions to continue to make the rules? I don't think we've had a problem now. It doesn't mean something couldn't happen tomorrow. But the institutions have policed it fairly well so far.
Right. Well, obviously they've done a good job in West Virginia so far, and we've not had any, praise the Lord, we've not had any issues on the campuses. But we know elsewhere in the country we've had instances where there have been shootings. And if you've noticed in the news nationally, the places where there are mass shootings and things like that are very often in places that are gun-free zones. So obviously somebody's breaking the law to break a gun in there. And I'll say that really my biggest point of allowing people to defend themselves in this way, even if they're not carrying, even if you have no students taking advantage of this law if it passes, you put that consideration in the mind of somebody who may want to hurt somebody, where normally in current circumstances they say, I'm gonna go in here and cause damage and shoot people. They know that those students and that faculty cannot protect themselves. If this law passes, there's that doubt in their mind, or they might think, well, gosh, I might go in here, there might be 20 people. Two or three of them might be armed, so maybe this is not such a good idea. So it's a deterrent.
But of course, on the other side, when you have youth and alcohol, and you put those together on a regular basis, you have greatly raised the risk of unintended harm. Danger to students who otherwise wouldn't be in danger.
Have you had any calls from in-state parents or out-of-state parents that currently have students there or possibly will send students there next year concerning with this?
So we've had a number of students, faculty, and staff who have expressed concerns. I would defer. I don't know. I would have to check on the parents. I just don't know off the top of my head on that piece.
Okay.
I would say my understanding, and I'm relying on the president of Fairmont State, who was in Kansas. I think they saw about a 6% enrollment drop the year after campus carry legislation was passed in that state. I can tell you that there was a piece of legislation that passed the Mississippi House within the past week or so that would allow concealed carry in their football stadium. The commissioner of the SEC issued a statement that from the SEC's perspective, they would do their best not to schedule home games in the state of Mississippi. And so, you know, as our teams compete, our soccer team was in the national championship 2 years ago. Our baseball team is on the rise with the new stadium. We want to remain, because we think it's important not only for us as an institution, but not only for the impact it has on our athletes, but the state, to remain a viable Power Five conference.
Statistics aren't the issue here. Risk is the issue here. You know, we're talking about a place where we don't have guns today, and that's by statute. It's Chapter 61. It's not a board policy. It's state statute. State statute allows us to restrict them. And we post those, and we restrict the guns through the state code. But what the risk is, if you have them, we don't have them now. You're going to add them, and I don't care what logic you come from. The logic is there's more opportunity for accidents, thefts of those guns. If you look at the three top issues that we have on campus as law enforcement, it's theft, vandalism, and simple assaults. Not one of those three will be solved by campus carry.
We have significant amount of research. I think we do about $170 million a year of federal industry and state-sponsored research, which means and that involves chemicals. And so we have nuclear, we have chemical materials, we actually have lab equipment that has, you know, with a lot of MRIs or magnet that we have to keep metals away from. And so from that perspective, in terms of a federal grant or a federal research project, if there are not some sort of limitations to keep firearms out of those settings, it could either an accidental combustion could do damage with chemicals, or it could damage equipment that we're using in research. So from a federal perspective in that instance, moving forward, we could have some challenges.
How many other states, you know, pretty much adopt, you know, this model legislation as it's presented to us? Are there any that pretty much have this model that's right in front of us?
It mostly starts off at a language like the one that's been introduced. And then throughout the process, the universities and the lead sponsors have worked out different scenarios to adjust it to each state accordingly. But yes, this would be the.
So after testimony in a closed-door caucus by Republicans, the bill passed in a voice vote, and it was referenced to the Committee on the Judiciary. Brad, do you think that with the strength of the gun lobby in this state that this is a done deal?
Boy, you know, I mean, if you really ask me, I'd say, what is the institution with the most influence in the state? And I would say it's WVU. But so now the question is the gun lobby more prominent than WVU is in terms of its influence? You heard WVU doesn't want this.
Now, once again, yesterday the governor held a press conference on PEIA and the teacher pay raise issue. Once again, he reiterated some of his proposals of freezing the current plan, but he also said that they need $22 million to do this. However, there's still some uncertainty of where that money would come from. Brad, do you want to comment about that?
Well, you know, we're coming out of what has been a couple of terrible budget years for the state, and we're still not. The governor keeps using the term happy days are here again. He's used it in the State of the State. He used it again this week. It's unclear. It still feels partly cloudy. Where you're going to find the money, the governor talked about potentially sacrificing the subsidies for community college that has been the pride of the Senate. But you got to find the money somewhere.
And he also talked about the teacher pay raises. However, his view differs a little bit from the version that passed out of House Finance. Jake, can you talk a little bit about the differences between his view on what it should look like and what passed out of House Finance?
Sure. Well, he's taken a little more fiscally conservative of a position. He's saying the raises should continue to go up at 1% increments by the year. The House sweetened the package a little bit. The House went 2-1-1-1, so 2% 1 year and then 1% for the next 3 years. And even that wasn't enough for some of the House Democrats. They wanted 3% up front. So that's going to be another balancing act of putting up the money up front and how are you going to figure it out in the off years.
And another interesting thing that happened this week was intermediate courts. So Senate Finance passed out that bill. And Brad, I know you've been covering pretty much every hearing involving intermediate courts. First off, can you just explain what an intermediate court is? What kind of cases they hear?
Yeah, it would split the state into northern and southern districts. There would be a three-judge panel in each. Potentially, they would be traveling courts, and civil appeals would go to these courts. criminal appeals would continue to go to the Supreme Court. The question has been, among other things, how much is it going to cost? The Supreme Court, which doesn't want this, provided an estimate, said around $12 million. The Republican majority doesn't believe that number, came up with their own number of around between $3 and $4 million. But given these other things we've talked about that the state needs or would like to spend on, can either of them be afforded?
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me this evening. Again, we have Brad McElhenney with West Virginia Metro News and Jake Zuckerman with the Charleston Gazette-Mail.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That's all the time we have tonight. Please join us Monday as we continue to cover all the activity of the 2018 legislative session. For everyone here at the Legislature Today, I'm Andrea Lanham. Thanks for watching and have a great weekend.